Hello,
I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. I'd like to talk a little bit today about the China claiming a whole lot of territory in the South China Sea and basically daring the United States to do something about it. What's going on there, Jim?
Well, this is a replay of something that really started in 2001. In early 2001, there was a lot of news because a Chinese jet fighter, naval jet fighter, had intercepted over international waters one of the Navy's electronic warfare monitoring aircraft, which was, of course, in international waters. Chinese fighter hit, you know, came close, too close, and hit the American, you know, four-engine aircraft, prop-driven engine. The American aircraft survived the collision. The Chinese aircraft and its pilot did not. To compound the problem, the nearest emergency landing field was in China. And there was a big kerfuffle after that, because even though the crew on the American aircraft went through the drill of destroying all their classified data on board, it later turned out that they might not have gotten all of it before they landed, and the Chinese grabbed everything, and it took, you know, 2 weeks, you know, to get the crew back. Chinese always blamed us. They continue to blame us, but it got worse after that, because that's when China was really starting to move into the South China Sea in a big way, doing what they describe as reasserting traditional rights. Now, unfortunately, they ran into many neighboring countries which have been asserting traditional territorial rights even longer. And China has since been called out for trying to rewrite history. But they persist because they're following ancient Chinese military wisdom. Sun Tzu, a famous Chinese military writer, sort of a cross between Mahan and Machiavelli, who basically counseled that the best victory is one that is won without fighting a battle. And there are numerous deception measures and techniques which Sun Tzu describes, which the Chinese are basically playing off. And they're quite open about it. They write articles, for the public saying, hey, this is ours, we're going to take it. They're playing the nationalist card. But what they're doing is, and this is in the news, they're building artificial islands, by dredging up sand on reefs. They've started landing warplanes on some of them. They're stationing long-range anti-aircraft missiles. And in the last few years, they've been insisting that all the space in the South China Sea, that's a large area through which, most of China's, sea trade goes through, is now Chinese territory. There's currently a case in front of an international court of arbitration, which China insists that it will not, abide by, even though they are making a lot of diplomatic effort, try and weaken the legitimacy of this court, which is internationally recognized as the authority in such, disputes. And of course, many Western nations, including Britain, have said that they will abide by any decision. So it doesn't really make any difference what the Chinese say about we're not going to, abide by this. If sanctions are imposed, China could be in big trouble because, their economy is highly dependent upon imports of oil, and exports of all sorts of goods. And the Chinese feel that they can basically, finesse this whole thing. To use a Western phrase, they can basically bob and weave. There's been more pieces falling into place. They have been asserting for over 10 years that foreign electronic warfare monitoring ships and aircraft operating outside of the territorial waters, that's 22 kilometers, from Chinese landmass, are illegal. Now, of course, the Russians did this sort of stunt, you know, back in the 60s, and they finally gave up when the United States and other nations, well, especially the United States, refused to back down. And that treaty was written where basically the Russians said, okay, we won't attack your aircraft or, you know, try and bully your ships anymore. But the Chinese are replaying that completely. And so far, the United States Navy has said, no, you know, we're not going to do it. But commercial airlines, for example, are basically obeying the Chinese request that they report in to Chinese air control in the South China Sea when they enter, you know, Chinese airspace, which now by Chinese reckoning is the entire South China Sea. So it's escalating slowly. The Chinese do not appear to want war because they can't afford one. But they keep escalating. And for example, another recent escalation, and we'll have a piece running on this next week, is they appear to have perfected a very long range, over 2,000 kilometers, maneuverable ballistic missile carrying a maneuverable conventional warhead. Now, this is basically an old technology. It goes back to the Nazis, basically, in World War II. Russia and the United States perfected it, you know, more or less in the 70s. But never implemented it for something like this. But the Chinese have been testing successfully this maneuverable warhead with allegedly a targeting system that could home in on a large ship like an aircraft carrier. At first, it appeared they were trying to do it with a missile that had a range of 1,500 meters. But the latest version, their DF-26. Which the American public became aware of in 2014, and the Chinese officially admitted they had in 2015, has a range of over 3,000 kilometers. So not only could it hit carriers at that range, if it works, but they could hit small land targets, namely a lot of key American military installations on the island of Guam. So this is very worrisome. Again, even though there's no proof, there's a lot of scary indications that, you know, such a system is there. And since it's non-nuclear, the Chinese wouldn't trigger a nuclear exchange, which they obviously want to avoid because that's turns out. But they're willing to push it apparently right up to the limit, playing chicken, as it were. Or during the 60s when Russians were playing that game, we called the chicken of the sea. And now the Russians lost that one, but the Chinese feel that they are better at it and they will succeed. Time will tell.
Austin?
Well, a lot to pick up on there. Jim's right when he points to 2000-2001 as an escalation of Chinese activities, but you can see the roots of Chinese expansion in to the southern waters, South China Sea. Mid-1970s, the Chinese pushed south, before the fall of South Vietnam, South Vietnamese forces off of islands in the Paracels. As a result, there's still conflict. I was going to say friction, but it's conflict with Vietnam, North Vietnam, over the Paracel Islands, and they spar a big, huge 6-week-long sparring contest at sea in 2014 over a Chinese exploration rig. We covered that heavily on Strategy Page. I did a couple of essays about it in my On Point newspaper column. That the push also accelerates. There's a slight acceleration, and it's notable. In the 1990s, as the U.S. pulls back from the Philippines, you had pressure from the Filipinos as an American imperialist, got to leave, goodbye Clark Field, pull out of Subic Bay, the Navy base. The volcano also rendered Clark all but unusable. What is it, Mount Pinatubo, I think? But,
yeah.
Isn't that the name of it?
Yes, that was one of the names.
Okay, all right. But, I mean, the thing is Clark and Subic were cornerstones of U.S. Southeast Asian operations, certainly with support. Of course, Leaving a little bit ahead here, Dan, as Jim had talked about the pushback that from its neighbors that China is receiving, boy, is it that the Filipinos have not only coaxed already the U.S. Navy back into Subic, even though Subic's being run as a Filipino naval base. I understand that we're going to have operations out of Clark, and there's going to be restoration work to put the airfield back in service for long-range aircraft, both transport and strike. And that is that's not only a military move; that's a diplomatic move on the part of the Philippines. Jim talked about Sun Tzu. Whether it was a Chinese consolidated empire or Chinese states, when they were in an expansionary mode and imperialist mode, they would use some of the tactics and operations in their own time that we're seeing the People's Republic do now, where they put out essentially forward operations. They can be under the mask as either a military outpost or even a civilian farmers. There's I did a column about this. There are several good articles that you'll find in 2014 on this about the so-called cabbage strategy, putting cabbages out and then the field grows around it. That's one way that's a metaphor for this. The cabbage strategy can be used to mean other elements as well, but you get the basic idea. You're going out doing planting, and then you're supporting what you've planted with diplomatic, economic, political, and military muscle. And that's certainly what we've seen in the South China Sea. Jim pointed out that under international law, what China has done is illegal. Jim also talked about what happened in the 1960s with the Russians trying to close off some of the I forget the naval term for it. I've heard it discussed. I've read it, and as you know, folks know who listen to our podcast, Jim and I shoot this off the top of our heads. But the ships have the right to pass through what are accepted international shipping lanes, even if they come within the 22 kilometer zone or outlying islands that are within that are regarded as being part of a nation. Hainan Island, which is the Chinese island, I believe that the P3C Ares, that's what that was. It was forced down in the spring of 2001. It landed on, I believe, it's an airfield at Hainan, and that's got the 22 kilometer, 12 mile zone around it. I'm not trying to use as direct example of the situation that the Russians were trying to exploit, but they were trying to deny what had been a traditional shipping right of passage and cutting through and making asserting total sovereign claim and exclusion. That was what the game was. Well, the Chinese are trying to do the same thing, even though in some ways they're a little bit more subtle about it, because they're demanding on these artificial islands that the manufactured islands is another way to describe it. In the South China Sea, they want you to give contact their air controller to get permission to fly over what was it was shallow sea, but it was open sea just 5 years ago in some places, and they want that. They certainly don't want you your ships coming close to them, and which is why the U.S. Navy has run some well-publicized FONOPs, Freedom of Navigation operations. That's what we did to the Russians in the 60s. We run them all the time. As a matter of fact, I did a little research for a column I wrote on FONOPs, I guess it was last year, and I found out that we'd run over a series of about 3 or 4 years that the Navy had run almost 60 of them, and the majority didn't have anything to do with the Chinese. The thing is, the ones that had to do with the Chinese or with Chinese claims are by far the most serious. The others were of rather minor issues with, I should say this to Iran and the Strait of Hormuz, but the Strait of Hormuz is open, a major international, recognized international shipping lane, but Iran likes to play the game of trying to close it, saying that that's Iranian territory. And, of course, in order to do that, they have to shove Oman and the United Arab Emirates, who they have an equal, quote-unquote, claim to it. But that's where the Navy ran other FONOPs that I would have to say had, to modify what I said vis-a-vis the Chinese. That's another place that you have a potential for armed conflict involving a Freedom of Navigation Act. So what do we have? We have an example of creeping imperialism on the part of the Chinese. It's a technique. We're seeing a very modern version of it. But it's a technique that you can see Chinese states using for the last 1,000 years. Sun Tzu lived in the 5th century BC, China. But as Jim pointed out, he gives a strategic guidance that a lot of it is epigrammatic, Dan. Brilliant work, absolutely brilliant work. But it's guidance and how to win. You want to win without risking combat. I do a section on Sun Tzu in the strategy class I teach at the University of Texas, and the way I approach it with my students is that these are their guidance for thinking up through the problem as you face it. And Sun Tzu spends a lot of time talking about how expensive of maintaining armies, the vast expense of maintaining military forces, and the risks of actual conflict, how expensive it is, and so hence you get and I'm paraphrasing it, the acumen of generalship is to win without fighting. It's not just relying on military forces, he wants all forms of power. And a succinct way, to bring it to bear, A succinct way of putting it is done by the Chinese scholar. Oh, I forget his first name. His last name is Wang, and he did an excellent translation of Sun Tzu. He says about gaining advantage. Sun Tzu is talking, trying to give you guidance in how to go about gaining advantage in order to obtain an objective. And I think that's a pretty good summary of it. If you're going to be synthetic and bring it down to one phrase. But what you see being the Chinese state doing in the South China Sea has a lot of connectivity to Sun Tzu's now 2,500-year-old guidance. So you've got a long-term and very useful strategic guidance. And some very, very smart people, as Jim said, they realized that U.S. carrier groups, if it came to a conflict, would be the center of a U.S. counteroffensive to stop them. So they've been working on building a ballistic missile that they can fire from a distance, long-range standoff weapon that has a maneuverable reentry vehicle. I think you'll see that MRV sometime. It's not multiple independently targeted reentry vehicle, the old MIRVs, but it is a maneuverable warhead that they want to at least get a. If it doesn't hit the carrier, they want to give the U.S. give us doubt that that carrier could operate operate freely, and it's something that they're not putting a lot of risk in, because they're not risking ships, they're not risking aircraft, and they manufacture 300 or 400 of these. Who knows? And they fire 200, they might get lucky. That's part of their strategy to keep us away. They want to push us away from their littoral, and that's how that missile that. What'd you say the latest iteration is? I know it was DF-26. I'll make sure I read that next week, Jim. I had kind of gotten behind on the technology. So, Dan, there you go. You got some strategy. You got some history, close-in history, and that's what they're doing, buddy.
So, Jim, what is the best way for the U.S. and the other allies to respond to this?
Well, we're basically doing it, at least on paper. We are, United States and some other navies are actually defying the Chinese claims by moving warships through these contested areas. But the Chinese have, again, they constantly come up with new ideas. For example, it's become fairly clear that they have organized a naval militia where they pay seagoing fishing ships, trawlers, to basically with cash, to send the ship and its crew out, as well as subsidies to build these ships in the first place, to go out and to not catch fish, but to, that's why they have to pay them, but to basically follow the orders of the Chinese Navy or Coast Guard and interfere with other fishing ships from countries which, have, better claims to the area. But they will also use these ships, to get in the way of warships. Again, this is the chicken of the sea tactics that the Russians used in the 60s and eventually, agreed to stop by treaty because it wasn't working. But the Chinese feel that, hey, we're smarter than the Russians and we can make it work.
Austin?
Yeah, I don't know that I have anything. Jim summed that up quite well. I think I want to come back to the point Jim made about that law of the sea and then the arbitration hearing. And it's the Philippines that have filed on the Chinese. And I won't say I've read in depth about the case, but I've been reading about the case, Dan, for at least the last 2.5 years. And the Filipinos, based on, everything that I've read, have got an absolutely solid case. As Jim said, the Chinese are rewriting history. In other words, they're lying about their claims. And it's, at least in the international arena, the support that the Philippines have is pretty convincing. Most of their neighbors. I think one of the neighbors who wasn't with them on it is Cambodia. I believe that they're not. But they've got you've got other Southeast Asian nations and East Asian nations supporting them. And the Chinese believe, Jim alluded to this, that they're big enough and strong enough militarily in the region and economically that it doesn't matter what that arbitrator decides. If they can't intimidate the arbitration committee, court, which they're trying to do, that's what the Chinese diplomatic effort is towards intimidation. They're just going to ignore it. Now, there's going to be payback for that. There'll be diplomatic and political payback. Jim implied there'd be sanctions. Well, Chinese think they're above sanctions. They think they could deal with that. However, they will pay a political price, one that certainly the very smart people in Beijing who are behind this are aware of. And the Philippines looks like, I'm not in a position to predict it. Maybe intimidation is going to work, but the Filipinos have the case. And that's going to be interesting to watch how that plays out.
Well, I guess we'll continue to watch this situation. I mean, we've talked about it a number of times before. This is like Jim talks about, the Chinese are playing the long game on this, and we'll just have to keep watching that game. It'll be interesting to see what happens if certain people get elected this next cycle in the U.S. and see how that affects what the U.S. Strategy is.
Let me make a quick comment on that. I told you, they get pushback. They've gotten pushback among their neighbors. We've talked about Southeast Asia, but take a look at North Asia, East Asia as well, from South Koreans and the Japanese. We've talked about their hardening attitudes to North Korea and China for letting North Korea run wild. What you're alluding to would be a form of U.S. pushback on certain potential presidential candidates and be potential presidents. It would be a hardening of attitudes towards the Chinese. Yeah, we talk about this all the time. They are playing a long game, just like Jim says, but it's a dangerous game. That's why we talk about it, because it's dangerous.
Right. All right. Well, we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, guys.
Until then. Bye. Bye-bye.